think of, published their dissertation as a book.
Yeah. Oh, really? Oh, yeah, Karen Starr.
Right.
Oh.
Yeah.
And so. Then she expanded it, I guess.
Well, her dissertation was pretty long because she did a theoretical dissertation. So they tend to be a lot longer. Not necessarily harder, but longer. Actually, Dustin's doing that. Well, possibly theoretical dissertation. Right? Although now you're toying with Auerbach and Silverstein like everyone else.
Yeah, I don't know.
Were you guys exposed to Auerbach and Silverstein when you were
they
here?
Were doing yeah. it, but I mean, I had a pretty good idea of what I wanted to do at that point, so I didn't really.
Yeah, they didn't go through it thoroughly with us.
Okay, it's become a virus. Almost
yeah,
everybody is doing
really?
It. Yeah, it's just taken over.
Wow.
So I think people have this conception that it's easier to do. So
I needed to prove that I can do stats at least once in my career. So.
And if you went to, we had
clearly didn't do it in class.
A former student whom you hadn't met, Jesse Suh, who graduated in 2003. You guys entered in 2006. He's a researcher. He's published in a number of journals. He gets grants. He's at Penn,
well,
University of Pennsylvania.
That's uncommon for us, I do.
Huh?
That's uncommon for us.
It's not common, but it's doable. So if you wanted to become a researcher, sky's the limit.
I think that's kind of a misconception, though, about the Auerbach and Silverstein. It's not really.
It's not a virus?
No.
Easy.
No, that it's a parasite, right?
Oh, I think it's a misconception.
Yeah.
It's not easy, but maybe it's simple. I mean, it does seem simple, not easy.
Maybe
but
concrete.
Clear cut, like, it, you know.
I don't think it is. I mean, did you guys attend the grounded theory lecture by Hillary's colleague from Columbia? She came and she spoke in the Long Island room. It was freezing cold that
yeah.
day. I don't know if you remember that.
The student who talked about dissertation
No.
Stuff,
This is a colleague of Hillary's from Columbia.
I think I had a meeting that day, but I'm using that scale for the other girl that I'm looking for.
Auerbach?
Yeah.
The scale?
Well, measure. I mean, whatever.
It's not a measure.
Approach.
It's a method.
Yes.
So I don't know if you attended that lecture. I don't think there's anything easy about it at all. But now Jessica in your class did a qualitative. She did Auerbach and Silverstein.
Yeah.
And she defended already, but that doesn't mean that hers was easier. She worked really hard last summer.
Yeah.
Just totally cranked it out.
Is it still a publishable thing?
Not in empirical quantitative journals, but in qualitative journals, sure. All right. Any other questions for our esteemed colleagues? What happened?
Jessica's crazy hair. I said she had a team of little people in there that came out and did all of her research work for her. Shook them out.
She worked hard. She worked really hard. So let's talk about reflective function, shall we? You guys review your manuals? It's a lot.
Yeah.
Right? So let me just give a brief overview and then
I am going to do a PowerPoint this afternoon.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay. I've been in class.
Yeah. So. Everybody got a copy of it.
Well,
so.
Okay. You want to? I can give you my copy, and I can just look on the test.
Wait, did you want to use my laptop to?
Oh, I wasn't. If you want to use the PowerPoint,
yeah, why not?
Pressure for me, so.
Yeah. So, let me set that up, but. Do you have it on a flash drive, or would I have to connect to the internet?
Ah, you would have to connect.
Okay. You have it?
I might be able to plug in my thing.
Okay,
here. Do you want to project it, or should we all just look on our computers?
Well, it's nicer.
One second.
It's projected.
No, I just connected.
mentalization different from just...
Ah, I'm glad you asked, Grasshopper.
Is that just... is it because it's... is it manualized? Is that what the difference is?
No. No, manualization is a term that's restricted to psychotherapy. This, these are constructs that we're measuring.
No, no, I meant... well, when, like, when you were comparing mentalization with DBT...
No, you don't compare mentalization with DBT. You can compare mentalization with mindfulness.
Oh.
A construct. You can't compare with a treatment.
I thought mentalization was like a psychedelic treatment.
No, there's a treatment called mentalization-based therapy.
Do you want to hold on to this?
That's what I was thinking.
To be the controller.
Yeah, there's mentalization-based therapy, and in that treatment... what do? They try to enhance patients' mentalization capacities.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. So like in DBT, what's the goal? You want to enhance patients' mindfulness skills. All right. So mindfulness and mentalization are two different constructs, but they are, I feel, conceptually overlapping. And I wrote a whole chapter about that in my book, Transforming the Internal World in Attachment by Jeff Goodman.
Part one or two?
This is volume one. 2010. So if you're interested, it's right on Amazon.com. Go out and order yourself a copy.
Available on Nook, Kindle, or...
Not yet. I don't think it's that at that point. Published by Jason Aronson Press. So get yourselves a copy. But I tackle that question. What's the conceptual overlap between these two constructs? And I actually have developed a Q-sort that measures mentalization and mindfulness in psychotherapy. But it hasn't been validated yet. So there's a dissertation if anyone's interested.
Don't agree until you've done Q-sort. Let alone.
You hated Q-sorting that much?
I didn't hate it, but at the end it was much easier to do. But it's a, you know, large learning curve.
Oh, yeah. It's a gradual learning curve. I agree with that totally.
Watching the videos is really what takes.
Yeah. Right. So if you did the child therapy, which we use videos for, Giacomo did the adult, and he used transcripts, and he's saying it's easier to code the transcripts.
So they did a couple of video ones, and it was a little more difficult taking your own notes. It's kind of more.
It's certainly easier. You can flip back and forth to a physical hard copy transcript, take notes, and. I can see Giacomo's one. I think we polled people who had done both, and they all agreed with you.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice to see it, but I don't
know. This Q-sort I've developed, by the way, is for adult psychotherapy. It's not for child psychotherapy. So transcripts would be the modus operandi. So let me just give you a broad context for this construct, and then we will move forward, and we'll get into how to apply it. So mentalization, just broadly, mentalization is a construct that was first developed by French psychoanalysts in the late 60s. And they talked about it in French, and it didn't really cross over the English Channel until like 1991. And Peter Fonagy, a British psychoanalyst, picked up on this idea in 1991, published the first paper, I think the first paper in English on mentalization, and he's been writing about it ever since, and it's really taken off as the pivotal change process in psychotherapy, according to him. And he and his colleague Anthony Bateman have published a book that suggests that actually all psychotherapies work through enhancing mentalization. It's just some do it better than others, like Animal Farm. Some pigs are more equal than others. Some psychotherapies set out to enhance mentalization, and those would be superior treatments. So mentalization-based therapy will be at the top of the food chain from Fonagy's point of view, because he co-developed the therapy with Anthony Bateman. But they argue in this book that actually the change ingredient in all therapies, even cognitive behavioral, however little they do it, is mentalization.
What about behavioral therapy?
even be anything that's verbally mediated would enhance mentalization to some extent. So if you're actually trying to do that, you're going to have better results than if you're not trying, but it just happens as a unintended side effect of what you think you're doing. So treatments like cognitive behavioral therapy, these other kinds of treatments, they work, but not for the reasons that the developers think they work. They work because they enhance mentalization, not because they're reinforcing appropriate, desirable behavior. So that's the general thesis behind mentalization-based therapy. So what is mentalization? Mentalization is similar to the other two constructs that we have coded so far. So once again, you know, when we made that transition from conceptual levels of object representation, you know, we were assessing for complexity and quality and differentiatedness. We had a little bit of trouble transitioning and encoding this new coding system in our brains. You know, we're going to have another transitional phase because it's going to be difficult doing that again, because they're all fair. We're actually, in my mind, we're moving in a certain direction toward more intersubjective states of mind. And so mentalization is the apotheosis of this gradual progression from conceptual levels to differentiation relatedness, and now finally to the pinnacle mentalization. At least that's how I see it in my mind. It's a hierarchical evolution that we're on. And it's also temporal too, because conceptual level was the first. The coding manual was developed in 91 or so, and then differentiation relatedness was like late 90s, and now we're into mentalization, and your manual was 98, I believe, 1998.
However, so, Blatt has had some thoughts on this after it came out.
Yeah, sure. I mean, he has his own turf, his own, he has to protect his own constructs, and you know, it's and Blatt, just to give you some perspective here, Blatt is like 83 years old. I mean, he's very vibrant and virile and enthusiastic, and you know, he's not slowing down anytime soon, but he's 83 years old. You know, Feinecke is like 61, 62. He's a relatively young guy comparatively. So I mean, they're from different generations, and I think Blatt wants to really protect his legacy. And Feinecke's up and coming. He's probably, right now, I'd say the most well-known analyst in the world, Peter Feinecke. Really taken over for Kernberg, I think, in that category.
You're shaking the foundations I stand on. Team Blatt all the way, Sydney. I hope you're listening.
Well, he would be very appreciative of that.
Yes.
But I see this as a progression toward more relational theory and relational constructs, and seeing people as existing within a context, and specifically a human context, that we aren't these hermetically sealed individuals who develop these representations by ourselves. We do them in relationships with other people. And I think that mentalization takes that step to its logical conclusion. So what is mentalization? According to Peter Feinecke, mentalization is the interpretation or the understanding of other people's and your own behaviors in terms of mental states. Okay? So it's interpreting, which is what psychodynamic therapists do anyway, but what they're saying is that we all are psychodynamic therapists to a larger or lesser extent. We do this all the time. It's going on even now. We size up other people's mental states. All right? And our own mental states. So we understand people's behaviors in terms of these mental states. So when I saw Dustin on his BlackBerry earlier, I attributed a mental state of Dustin as being disinterested in what we were doing. And see, I know I can say this because I know that he knows I'm not putting him down, but that's how it works. Okay, so I saw that you know, Richard is there working, taking notes. He's very focused on what I'm saying right now. So I'm attributing a mental state of his as being, you know, invested and enthusiastic about what we're talking about.
Or he's Skyping.
That's also a possibility. So,
that's where I'm taking it.
So that's a possibility. So in that case, Chris is suggesting that we can't read Richard's mind and that his mind is ultimately opaque. What does opaque mean? It means you can't see through it. So a window is transparent, but that door is opaque. I can't see through it. So people's minds are ultimately opaque. We can't read other people's minds. We can try to, we can guess. So my guess was that Richard was enthusiastically taking notes about every word I was saying. Because he's kind of anxious and, you know, he's not a student yet and he wants to soak in everything he can, right? That's my impression of Richard. Chris had a totally different impression. So he's attributing a totally different mental state to Richard, which is also possibly true, that Richard was actually texting or Skyping or not even paying attention to what I was saying. He was doing what Dustin was doing, only he's more discreet about it because I can't see what he's doing on there.
So these are cognitive states, not just
emotions? It's everything. It's a cognitive, emotional, mental state. It can be beliefs, feelings, thoughts, intentions, fantasies.
So really any state.
Any mental state.
Versus, as long as it
occurs inside the person.
Right, like what you're thinking. Yeah. Versus theory of mind, which is just the awareness that you are thinking.
No, this is all part of theory of mind. It's not separate from theory of mind, but Fonagy has more precisely defined theory of mind in terms of psychological as opposed to strictly cognitive. So if you're familiar with the theory of mind literature, it's very cognitively focused. Mm-hmm. Fonagy is taking theory of mind literature and he's boiling it down to a psychological construct. And the way that you measure mentalization for Fonagy is through the reflective function, and that's the scale that we're going to be learning. Dustin.
Does this come out of the AI?
Yes, I'm going to get to all of that.
It's like
ESP.
Huh? It's like ESP.
No, it's the opposite of ESP, because we can only guess.
Oh, okay.
Actually, the belief in ESP would be a low level of mentalization, because those people don't believe in the opaqueness
of people's
minds.
It's a negative one, bizarre and unusual.
Exactly.
Okay.
It'd be like the telepathic wind.
Right.
But mentalization, does that imply that you understand, that you start to understand that people's minds are opaque and that you can't read?
That there's multiple
That's
possibilities.
At the higher level, I mean, like at the more common level, it's at least trying to be able to, you know, attribute motive to what somebody's doing.
Whether you're right or wrong.
Yeah. Or, I mean, based on the context of what you know about yourself and this other person, you know.
And the higher level would represent kind of an awareness that there are possible multiple.
Absolutely, absolutely. You have to know that people read minds all the time. We do it all the time. Unconsciously we do it in implicit memory. So all this right brain kind of activity is this implicit realm. And in the implicit realm, we're mentalizing and we don't even know we're doing it. So mentalizing goes on whether we're conscious of it or not. And Fonagy's and Bateman's treatment is designed to make this implicit mentalization that we do more explicit. So put it over more into the left brain, or make the left brain aware of what the right brain kind of implicit mentalization is doing.
So they hang out with Buddhists.
Well, the Buddhists are more the mindfulness people.
Right.
I think there's an overlap. Yeah. I definitely think there's an overlap. And also mentalization-based therapy is done in the here and now. It's all here and now. There's no going back into the past and exploring your deep, darkest childhood, you know, memories. They don't do that. So in that sense, it's similar to Kernberg's transference-focused psychotherapy, which is also here and now, just like DBT. So all the borderline treatments are here and now treatments, which is Buddhist-influenced. But DBT is the most Buddhist influenced of all three of those treatments.
So when they try to start talking about things in the past, do you direct it away from that?
Well, you try to figure out, okay, what mental state were you in that made you think about escaping what's going on in the here and now?
Okay.
Right? So what's going on between you and me that you had to talk about your past?
Okay. Okay.
You see?
Yeah.
So it's considered an avoidance of what's going on between you and me right now. The, as Martin Buber would say, the I and thou relationship. The interaction in the room at that moment. What's going on. And I just went to this DBT-MBT conference that happened at Yale a couple of weeks ago. Bateman did a demonstration in vivo, and it was really interesting to see him. He did it with an actress playing a borderline patient, and it was completely focused on the here and now. It was just incredible. There was no history, nothing like that. Just what's going on between you and me right now. So, you like that?
I love it.
Yeah,
more than anything in life. This is, I love it. I want to learn more.
All right.
I can't contain my...
The mental state is a little bit of sarcasm.
No,
but also some enthusiasm and interest. See, so I could... She has maybe some dual mental states going on that I'm perceiving, right? So that's a little bit higher level mentalization than... thinking, I can't read her mind at all, so why even bother? Or, I know exactly what's on her mind, and she's being sarcastic right now. No, that's not the whole story. So, huh?
I'm like really excited.
Okay. So, you guys starting to understand. So, and it's mostly, it's focused a lot on behavior, like nonverbal behavioral cues. So, but you can just take verbal text and decipher mental states. What's the person's mental state, or how are they interpreting another person's mental state based on how they're describing the person or describing their relationship to the person? So that's why I think it's very appropriate and very plausible to take this construct and apply it to Giacomo and Chris's data, because the question being asked is describe these three individuals, right? Father, mother, and self. And we're going to get mental states. We're going to get no mental states. We're going to get different quality of mental states. So our job is to take these descriptions that we're given and try to figure out A, what mental states are being described, right? And we're going to underline those. And then assigning scores to those mental states. Now, Fonagy decided that the best way of assessing mentalization was to use an instrument that was going to create some stress in the individual. So mentalization, one thing you need to know about mentalization is that it varies with stress. So under high levels of stress, do you think mentalization would increase or decrease?
Decrease.
Okay, why?
Not at all.
Huh? You think increase?
Depends.
Why
on
increase?
Because when you're under a state of stress, so if you're like hyper-aroused, you are picking up on many different things. You're all sorts of information is flying around, so you might be more likely to think that maybe it's this or this or this state or this or this or this state.
I see a low level of anxiety. Perhaps optimal in some conditions, some environments, but not preparing.
I feel like I'm going to invoke the Shore book, and if this part of your brain is aroused with emotionality, this part of your brain with the kind of rational thought decreases. So you might be hyper, you know, attuned to one thing, but you'll be kind of missing out like on the rest. So as emotionality increases,
that's the right answer.
Decreases.
So what happens if you're under a high degree of stress? You get very, very focused on one thing, and you lose a lot of information.
But a moderate degree of stress would be optimal then.
Yeah, moderate.
Deactivating your executive function.
Exactly. So we want the executive function to be online. What the AAI does is that it stresses the individual, but not in some extreme fashion. How does it stress the individual? The AAI is designed to, quote, surprise the unconscious by asking the individual who's being interviewed questions about the nature of their relationships to their primary caregivers between the ages of 5 and 12. And what you have to do basically, I mean, I'll do a real quick mini AAI with you guys. All right. Just take a minute. So, think about your relationship with your mother during the ages of 5, between the ages of 5 and 12. Got it? Now, you don't have to say it out loud, but try to think of 5 adjectives to describe your relationship with your mother between the ages of 5 and 12. 5 adjectives. You got them? It's hard, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't.
It's very difficult.
Yeah.
I'm hovering on 3.
My unconscious is retreating.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would expect that. Now, I mean, if I were actually doing an AAI with you guys now, I'd take as long a time as you needed to come up with the 5, but I would really insist that eventually you come up with 5. So then you come up with 5 adjectives. Then I say, and remember, you've never done an AI before, so this is coming by surprise. I'm surprising you. I want you to give me 2 specific memories for each of those adjectives. Now, there's some people who can't do that task at all. Can't do it. Other people can come up with 2 specific memories pretty easily for all 5 adjectives.
Within at that time period?
Yes. Specific memories to describe that adjective during that period of time. Now, I would argue that those people who can come up with the 5 adjectives and come up with 2 specific memories during that time frame for each adjective are securely attached individuals.
Can.
Doesn't matter how horrible those adjectives are. It could be, my mother was hateful. She was mean. She was nasty. She was cold. She was indifferent. If that person can come up with 2 specific memories for each of those adjectives, specific, not semantic memories or procedural memories, but episodic specific memories, that's what's important. See, I could say, well, my mother was mean around the dinner table at night when we were growing up. Well, that's not a specific memory. That's called a semantic memory, and that's a memory that's kind of been generalized over many, 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 many experiences over time. That doesn't count. It has to be a specific instance that you recall that would illustrate that adjective that you've come up with. It's a very difficult task, and it puts the respondent under a high degree of stress. Maybe not cataclysmic stress, but high degree of stress. So then after that, then you ask the respondent to name 5 adjectives to describe your relationship with your father during the same time period, ages 5 to 12. And then you do the same process, 2 specific memories per adjective.
I'm sorry, you said adjectives to explain the relationship with that person?
Yes.
Or adjectives to describe that person?
The relationship.
Because you said mean during dinner. That's not an adjective that would describe...
She was mean to me.
To
oh, she was mean. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, that's the first part of the interview, and then you go into the second part and you ask questions like what kind of an impact do you think your childhood had on your adult personality? Now that's a very important question when you go to assess reflective function. So anyway, the interview is a really powerful instrument. It's been validated and it's been shown to be reliable cross-culturally, and it's been replicated in literally hundreds of studies. It's an extremely powerful instrument, and the coding system was developed by Mary Main. The actual interview was developed by Carol George, and Fonagy was trained by Maine. He came over and he did the training. The AI training is a 2-week, 8-hour-a-day training. It's very intensive. It costs thousands of dollars. I did my training with Carol George. You actually, at the end, if you want to become reliable with Mary Maine, you have to code 30 interviews that Mary Maine has personally picked out and coded herself. So then you become reliable with Mary Maine. And if you don't get the 80% reliability with her on major classification, there are 4 of them. So you have a 25% chance of guessing correctly. Then she gives you another batch of 10. And she does this maybe 2 or 3 other times. And if you still don't reach the 80%, you fail. And you don't get your money back. So, I know people who they code AAIs for a living because they get a name for themselves and they charge, you know, $135 a pop to code one of these suckers, you know, and that's what they do.
How long does it take to code?
Well, once you get really skilled, you know, it can take like an hour. So you're doing okay. I charge $150 for a therapy session. So charging $135 for an hour of coding, it's not bad. But when you first start out, trust me, it takes about 6 hours to code one interview when you start out. So
keys to it.
Huh?
It's like the key sword.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's painful. So,
informative and makes you a better clinician.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You look for things that you wouldn't normally look for. So anyway, Fonagy decided to look for these mental states depicted in the AAI. He thought this was an ideal instrument to do this with because he really conceptualized reflective function as coming out of the attachment relationship, and he defined it really out of attachment theory, Bowlby's theory of attachment. So he took the AAI and he developed a manual around the AAI. So traditionally you administer the AAI and then you code it for the attachment classification, and then you code it for this reflective function score, so from -1 to 9. But more recently, people have adapted the manual for other data sets. So it's been expanded beyond the original realm of the AAI, and in 2006, there was an article published that applied the manual to psychotherapy transcripts. So you look for mental states, interpretation of mental states, or interpretation of people's behaviors in terms of mental states in psychotherapy transcripts. We've had a couple of people in Blatt's research group who have applied it to the ORI, the Object Representation Inventory, which is what Giacomo and Chris administered to their subjects online.
Team Blab.
So without further ado, we will do the presentation. How long is this? You know?
Like 9 times 5.
Okay.
Okay. So.
You want to get the lights?
Oh wow. We're making this official.
Absolutely. We spent time doing this, so we're going to take it serious.
Okay, so this is the reflective functioning scale version 5. So hopefully, it's lucky it doesn't say blab. So hopefully, since they've had 5 versions to work through, I think looking through the manual myself, it's dense, but it's clear-cut. Like, they're very specific about the rules and, you know, in-between stages, which I think is a little pain in the butt at the beginning, but it'll be nice, like, if you're kind of unsure, you can really kind of go through and look. So when we get to the scales, we'll be able to go. But reflective functioning, also interchangeably used with mentalization, is the active expression of the psychological process underlying the capacity to mentalize. It is intimately related to the representation of self. So although they're related, they're different, but you need to have, I would think, well-developed self-representation in order to kind of pull from that experience and be able to use reflective capacity on somebody else. And also, similarly, I think with the DR scale, they kind of probably develop in relationship to one another. So without having had that reflective experience with your mother and your father or your caregiver, you're not really going to have that fully developed sense of self.
Well, that's how sense of self develops.
Yeah. Let's see. So, it is intimately related to representation of self. RF also involves both a self-reflective and an interpersonal component that ideally provides the individual with a well-developed capacity to distinguish inner from outer reality, pretend from real modes of functioning, intrapersonal mental and emotional processes from interpersonal communication. So, I mean, as Jeff was kind of saying before, it's not just taking in what you're seeing with your eyes and hearing with your ears, but also kind of trying to attribute something, unseen into that opaqueness where you're able to kind of pull some sort of meaning out of what's going on and hopefully kind of organize your world in a little bit more efficient manner.
Right, we use facial expressions, we use gestures, behavioral gestures, we use prosody, that's the tone of voice, to determine a person's state of mind, their mental state. We do it all the time.
RF is the developmental acquisition that permits individuals to respond not only to another person's behavior, but to the individual's conception of others' beliefs, feelings, attitudes, desires, hopes, knowledge, imagination, pretense, deceit, intentions, plans, and so on. So, I mean, the more you know somebody else, you gather kind of the store of information, so you're also kind of pulling from that and maybe also interpreting, for future moving forward. So since I have all this information about Melissa and she's doing this now, I can kind of infer that maybe this is the reason, or given a novel situation, this might be, what she would do. By attributing mental states to others, individuals make people's behavior meaningful and predictable.
Yeah, that's very important. Why do we do, why have humans evolved to have this skill? Well, we need our world to be somewhat predictable. So we need to have expectations of how people are going to act. So we interpret facial expressions, behaviors, body language, tone of voice. We do all of this so that we can kind of figure out what they might be thinking and feeling, then we can behave accordingly.
I mean, if we didn't, we would all be like 3 and 4 year old, why? Why are you doing
exactly.
that? Why are you doing that? Why are you doing that?
So we can kind of infer people's motivational states, right? We can try to figure out, okay, this is what's motivating this person. So it's all about intentionality.
As individuals learn to understand other people's behaviors, they can flexibly activate for multiple sets of self other representations they have organized on the basis of prior experiences, the one or ones best suited to respond adaptively to particular interpersonal transactions. So like in the previous scales, how we were kind of looking at not just, like the representation in the first scale of self, other, and mother, but then also within a relational context, you kind of draw upon those things for when you meet new people. He reminds me of so-and-so, or so-and-so does this, maybe it means that. So, I mean, you can kind of apply it moving forward to make meaning out of transactions in the world. RF refers to the capacity to perceive and understand oneself and others in terms of mental states, so feelings, beliefs, intentions, desires. So that for me, kind of on the conceptual level scale, that level 7, the kind of the internal iconic where you're first going, so those kind of attributes we scored at that level there would be like the internal states. It also refers to the capacity to reason about one's own and others' behaviors in terms of mental states, which is reflection.
Or, as Chris might say, reflection.
I'm surprised Spellcheck didn't pick that up. So why is reflective functioning important? So, I mean, the manual gives a bunch of lists a list of things that weren't all applicable to what we'll be doing, or else also what the research was. But RF enables an individual to see people's actions as meaningful. Actions become predictable, which in turn reduces the dependence on others to explicitly detail the meaning of their actions. RF helps individuals distinguish between appearance and reality. Until individuals are able to manage the task of reflection, there it's spelled correctly, they remain vulnerable to their own and others' immediate emotional reactions. Prior to the development of RF, inconsistency or hostility from others is more likely to be taken at face value as showing something bad about the individual. So one of the examples they gave in the manual was when working with like extremely traumatized youth who you know, perhaps did not have the best upbringing or had bad things done with them. Without the capacity to be reflexive, they might think that they were bad, so bad things happened to them, or you know, just very simplistic and unilateral and those kind of things, you know, without really seeing, well, maybe this person, you know, it was due to this person's own set of internal issues that they did this to me and I didn't really deserve it. So they're not able to kind of separate that out. Or with the borderlines, I feel this, I have to do this right now. I can't sit with it and kind of contemplate on it. RF can also help an individual to achieve deeper experiences with others, and ultimately a life experience is more meaningful. It allows the successful connection of internal and external, which allows belief to be endowed with meaning, which is emotionally alive but manageable. So maybe the mild stress condition, which kind of leads to a more, whatever it leads to. I'm blanking on it. One of the other things that they found in the manual was that those with higher RF tend to have children that are more securely attached. So if you're planning on having kids.
Even if they had secure attachments, too, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, because I think with the type of mentalization, you know, training as you go, even though you might not have had it, if you're able to kind of be more self-reflective, you're able to do that for the child.
If you've had therapy, for example, or you're in a loving relationship where some of that, you know, security can be repaired.
Right. Because the attachment pattern can change over time, right?
It can. But there has, you know, as you get older, internal working models become increasingly resistant to change.
Right.
So it's harder to change as you get older. It's going to need a more extreme impact to change it. Like a therapy, like a car accident, like a wet marriage, you know, something that's very intense can change it.
Are you comparing marriage to a car accident?
I wanted to pick two very different balanced experiences that could both have an impact.
Okay. Just staying in the here and now.
Okay.
So, the RF scale, there are points in between each of these, I mean, similar to the first measure, but again, in the manual, they're much more clearly kind of cut. But it starts at a negative one or a negative RF. A score of one would be absent but not repudiated RF. Three would be questionable or low RF. Five is definite or ordinary RF. Seven is marked RF. And nine is full or exceptional RF. So a one or negative RF, it's an anti-reflective response which expresses hostility or an active evasion in response to an opportunity for reflection. So this could be a score of negative one or zero. These scores must be distinctly anti-reflective or bizarre and inappropriate. So an example, I think, from you know what we may have encountered already of somebody who would get a negative one score would be, I choose not to answer this question. They are asserting that they aren't going to engage in this reflective process. Mm-hmm. Also, if you see the telepathic whirlwind, that's just going to be a negative one or a zero also because of the bizarre content of
or
it.
Monster.
That could be. One, which is an absent but not repudiated RF. This rating is given when the subject does not mention mental states in spite of the opportunity to do so. responses may be sociological, overly concrete, excessively generalized, or overwhelmingly egocentric. So my
uncle is 81 years old, and I've asked him what his childhood was like, and my dad's brother, and he says, your dad and I, we grew up in the Depression. We was poor. And that's all he can come up with. That's a sociological explanation of his childhood. So that would be an RF1.
Somebody like the vague, I don't really know, I really can't say. They've kind of disowned their reflective capacity in that. They haven't refused to answer the question, but they're stating that, maybe I can't really engage in this or I don't want to say. But there's not that kind of assertive aggressiveness to it where it's a refusal. I think life was hard for mom. I mean, making a living and raising kids is a lot of work. It was a struggle. Although that's a fairly somewhat sophisticated and believable answer, it's very concrete and it lacks any internal state whatsoever. So they've completely left out thoughts, feelings, wishes of mom, anything. So, I mean, that one might be a little bit more of a tricky one where it looks like a nicely thought out answer, but when you look at it, it's all, very behavioral or very concrete.
I have a question about the previous slide. It said, if you took away the I really can't say, and it was just a vague I don't know, would it still fall under a one category? Or is it the I really can't say, because that's kind of the disowned piece of really thrusting it into one category?
I think both aspects of it, it's not like I refuse to answer this question or I will not answer it. They're saying that kind of that lost or, unsure quality of it.
Yeah, did you say the negative one came into play after treating antisocial interesting?
Yeah.
Actually, people who've been in prison populations.
Right.
Actually, I have to go to a dissertation defense, believe it or not, at Danielle's house. So can we pick this up next week?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait,
not next week. 2 weeks. Yeah, we're not here next week.
Yeah, 2 weeks. I'm sorry. 2 weeks. Yeah. And we're meeting at 6 o'clock. In 2 weeks, that's what I have written down?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So thank you, everybody. Keep reading these manuals. You can email me questions if you like.
Sorry. I didn't even warn you.
Really bad.
Developmental stages of thinking,
Conceptual elements, at least up one through five were. Piaget was a good guy. He gave people lots of useful information and observations for these. Because it's all like a childhood development.
We have a bulletin board right by our office.